and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On this week's show, I enter the headquarters of the most powerful film franchise on Earth, Bond, as we celebrate the life of legendary producer Cubby Broccoli. You only live twice? Rubbish. If you're a vampire, you live forever, especially in Sweden. I meet up with director Thomas Alfredson to bite into one of the most original horror movies of the century so far, Let the Right One In. Sam Brooks and I will get our fangs into the week's releases, including Zac Efron in 17 Again and Chilling Chilean Disco in Tony Manero. License to Review. We're Weekly. Film Weekly. The man credited for turning James Bond into the most famous spy in the universe, the larger-than-life producer Cubby Broccoli, is being celebrated in a two-month season at BFI Southbank. To mark the centenary of Cubby's birth, I went down to Eon House in London's Piccadilly to meet up with his daughter, Barbara Broccoli, and stepson, Michael Wilson, who carry on producing the Bond films today. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang was on the wall, a big poster of From Russia With Love beamed down on me as I entered through the wooden doors in Piccadilly, through Moneypenny's office and into the boardroom where high chairs like Smirsch headquarters surrounded us. I started out by asking Barbara how proud she must be to see her father's work recognised at somewhere as august as the National Film Theatre.
Oh, definitely. I mean, Cubby Broccoli, my father, was an extraordinary man, and you know, he assembled with Dr. No the most astounding group of talented directors and craftsmen, and created with his partner Harry Saltzman a new genre of films.
Neuf à la banque.
I need another 1,000.
I admire your courage, Miss
Trench. Sylvia Trench. I admire your luck, Mr.
Bond. James Bond.
I was wondering, you know, when you look at a producer's work, it doesn't kind of have the auteurist stamp of, say, a director. But I suppose Cubby has kind of created a genre himself, so almost that he's had great directors work on the films, but it's got the imprint of Broccoli all over it.
Yeah, well, he was a creative producer, and there are a few, sadly not as many today as there used to be, but he was someone who was very involved in the creation of the script and the selecting of the major crew, the director and the heads of department. He was and he would like to sit on the set and be there in case anything needed his attention, and he just loved making films. It was his life.
I remember when it was the anniversary of an exhibition of Pinewood photographs, and I saw you there, Barbara, and I asked you what Pinewood meant to you, and you said it was like going to Grandma's house. Did you really grow up there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we would come out, my sister Tina and I would come after school. When we had early school release on Friday, we'd come out to Pinewood and play in the gardens there and hang out on the sets. And yeah, it is like a second home.
So when you do produce, do you kind of, is there a moment when you think, well, what would Cubby have done? Or is that just innate now? You know what he would have done and what he would have wanted.
I think we think about him all the time, both consciously and subconsciously. Often when we're in a bit of a pickle, we'll sit and think, or I will sit and think, what would Daddy do? And then I think, okay, that's what he'd do, so that's what we're going to do. I mean, he always believed that you had to be decisive, you know, that it was very important to get as much information as you needed and then make a decision.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose you thus agonize over decisions that he perhaps wouldn't have taken whenever you want to change it. I suppose the biggest example comes whenever you're changing up your James Bond, which is a creative decision that he had to face when Sean Connery went to Roger Moore and George Lazenby came in, and then you've had to do it with Tim Dalton a bit, and then Pierce and Daniel Craig. The latter decision, of course, has been a huge boost and re-energizing decision. Did he used to kind of agonize over those?
He was very careful about making decisions, thoughtful. He was a great listener, which I think was a critical part of his success. He would listen to people. He believed, you make a decision and you move on. You don't really agonize once you've made a decision.
Right. He'd have liked Daniel Craig, I think. Though.
Oh, you betcha.
I have to ask you about the centenary that's on at the BFI Southbank, because it isn't just Bond. Obviously, some of the greats form part of it, as I mentioned, from Russia with Love, which is actually my favourite Bond film of all time.
Is it really?
You're not allowed to say that.
Of the Sean ones, it's my favourite.
Oh, okay. See, it's like favourite children. You're not really allowed to say, but it is a beautiful film.
So you're Tatiana Romanova?
My friends call me Tanya.
Mine call me James Bond. Well, now that we've been properly introduced.
Careful! Guns upset me.
I'm sorry. I'm a bit upset myself.
You look just like your photograph.
You're one of the most beautiful girls I've ever seen.
Thank you. But I think my mouth is too big.
No, it's the right size. For me, that is.
But it wasn't just about Bond as well. That's what it intrigues me. Of course, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, the movie that Cubby produced. Just tell me a bit about how he got involved in that, because it seems to be, I know it's written by Ian Fleming as well, but it seems the antithesis of Bond.
Well, I mean, it was Ian Fleming, obviously, that that introduced him to the book. And it's a wonderful story because Fleming, I believe, wrote the book for his son, Casper, because Casper said to him one time, "I think you love James Bond more than me." So it was really a love story to his son from him. And I think that's very moving. And I know that my father, Cubby, enjoyed making the film tremendously. And he also did it because he wanted to make a film that his kids could watch. And we were all pretty young at that time. Mm. So we're going to be showing that film, and I know many generations of kids have enjoyed it, and he'd be very pleased.
Mm-hmm. Do you know all the words?
You bet. I know them all.
You said that Casper Fleming said to his dad that, "I think you love James Bond more than me." Did you ever have to level that accusation at Cubby?
No, I didn't. But, growing up, I thought James Bond was a real person up until I was about 7 or 8.
He isn't? Dad, what am I doing here?
Because he was always talked about. And so I had the impression he was some, distant relative or something. So it was a bit of a shock when I found out the truth, almost like finding out about Father Christmas.
I mean, it's a kind of an odd thing for a father to leave a legacy, not to a boy like yourself. Anyway, you were a seasoned man by the time the Bond was up and running. But to you, Barbara, a father leaving this kind of unreconstructed chauvinist, as Judi Dench once called him not so long ago, a man who kind of kills and thrills and drinks martinis and sleeps with women. This is not a male role model to set to a young girl.
Sounds like most of the men I've met.
Before we go and celebrate your father's centenary, do we have any clues for Bond? What are we now, 21 it's going to be?
More like 23.
23 we're up to. God, they go so fast.
We don't have any plans yet. We're working on it. We hope. We'll be back.
Yes, because it's only just now out on DVD. The Quantum of Solace doing fantastic business as well, and I loved Quantum of Solace. I have to say, that was a thrill for me. I was on the edge of my seat. I still am on the edge of my seat talking to you guys. So plans are afoot. We're going to see Bond 23. That's for sure. Daniel Craig.
Yes, definitely Daniel Craig.
Do you think he should come back?
Yeah. People want the shorts again. They missed the shorts. Michael Wilson, Barbara Broccoli, thank you so much. Enjoy the celebrations of your father's 100th birthday. That's a big cake. Zan Brooks is here to run the rule over the week's releases. Zan, are you a Bond fan?
Yeah, who isn't a Bond fan?
Yeah, you're right.
And I think even, it's probably one of those adolescent pursuits that you've got to leave behind. But even when you do, there's still a kind of sneaking, nostalgic affection for them.
Yeah, I mean, you still like Casino Royale and even Quantum of Solace a bit.
I like those a lot. Yeah. And obviously I love the old Connery ones, Diamonds Are Forever and Goldfinger and stuff like that.
I'm a Russia with Love man.
Oh, yeah, that's fantastic.
All the way. Chitty Bang Bang, what about that?
Well, that was one of the lesser known Bonds, wasn't it? By Ian
yeah, but
Fleming.
Great car nonetheless. I got to say, Zan, let's haul ourselves into the present and start with 17 again. It stars teen idol Zac Efron, fresh from High School Musical 3. He starts life as Matthew Perry, then goes back to high school where he was a basketball hero.
No way! It's freaking me out.
It's freaking me out! I'm pubescent. This is my chance to have my life over, but to do it right. I'm going back to high school, man.
Don't even think about sucking me into it with you.
I'm here to enroll my son.
Sup?
What is this you're wearing?
This is hip.
What'd you do, Mug Cave Head?
What are you wearing? You look like Clay Aiken.
now...
Why is the new kid waving at me?
He's back in class.
What are you eating?
I don't even know. I just know I'm hungry.
Zan, is he someone you even know who he is?
Yes, I've seen the High School Musicals.
You're down with
and
kids.
kind of hated them. And so imagine my surprise when I actually quite liked this.
Did you?
I did.
And why?
I don't know what's wrong with me. Why? I thought he was okay in it.
He isn't bad. I've got no beef with Efron.
Yeah, I mean, basically, he's weirdly convincing, playing a kind of crusty, sour old man in a sort of the body of a hormonal Adonis who everybody's kind of falling over to touch.
Yeah, because, I mean, when I saw him, the first time I saw him, I think he was in Hairspray, wasn't he?
Yeah.
As well. He wasn't too bad in that. Then High School Musical 3 last summer, where he starts the whole ball rolling with a basketball scene.
Well, literally, yeah. And this film is kind of cynically capitalising on
that,
doesn't it?
That's what they're doing.
It has him kind of oiled at the start, throwing hoops.
I saw it in an audience that was full of young girls, yeah, which is a nice change for me, I must say, than sitting with people like you. And they screamed as soon as he came on screen.
Yeah, he's got it, hasn't he?
Yeah.
For the tween demographic.
Yeah, lucky old Zach. I think it was the teachers of some of those girls who were clearly on school holidays that were actually screaming, but there again, that's another matter. So do explain all this, because it's a body swap comedy, kind of like Big, but like, he's got a bit of
everything in this, hasn't it? It's got a bit of Big, it's got a bit of Back to the Future, it's even got a bit of It's a Wonderful Life, in that he kind of goes back and has his time over again and kind of realises that you know, things aren't as bad as he initially thought they were.
And there's a clear nod to that, because it happens in a storm and Matthew Perry's
driving
along.
Yeah, and he falls into the river that rolls through town and all that. So it's very kind of cynically handled, I think, and plagiarises from everywhere, and it's full of kind of slightly cheap comedy and obvious contrivances and you know, sugared sentiment.
And yet you loved it.
And yet I...
I loved it.
Yeah, no, I didn't love it, but I was surprised that I found it sort of perfectly passable and even kind of enjoyable, and even, I hesitate to say, oddly moving at times in its sort of themes of wasted youth, I guess.
Really? So this spoke to you? Because, I mean, I never had
me.
A moment where...
You
where,
never had a moment of wasted youth?
Of wasted youth. No, I capitalised fully
right.
on my youth.
And that's why
it's adulthood
you're where you are
I'm
today.
Frittering away. I noticed it was directed by someone called Burr Steers.
Yeah, it's a great name, isn't it?
Isn't it? I think if I recommend this to someone...
He's got to be a Texan, hasn't he?
I would have thought so.
Like that.
Burr Steers. Well, I didn't want to give anyone a bum steer, but I wouldn't really recommend going to see this. But
do you know what this reminded
did.
Me of? Have you ever read the John Updike rabbit novels?
Yes, I have indeed.
And this is like a kind of Disney version of the rabbit novels, where Rabbit is the sort of the high school basketball star, but in this he gets to go back and
yes,
do it all again.
That is true. My problem with this was that the comic logic didn't work. And I know that's what, when Zac Efron's taking his top off, that's the last thing people are thinking of. But it just didn't, the actual consistencies didn't work. So he's supposed to be still Matthew Perry, so he's dating his mum again, or
he still fancies his
quite hot actually,
yeah,
but his daughter's
coming on to him,
so that's a bit odd, I thought, but it didn't quite fully, I thought that was really could be creepy, but it didn't really go with that,
it didn't really go with that, and you know, we can't sort of unpick the logic of a body swap comedy, time travel comedy.
I mean, something like Groundhog Day.
Yes,
you do,
okay.
And
that
it works.
Was a lot better than this. And also I had a slight problem thinking that Zac Efron is the young Matthew Perry when they really look nothing alike at all.
He sort of was doing... I quite like what Zac Efron was doing. He was kind of doing a Matthew Perry impression.
He was.
So he was talking like that, like Chandler Bing.
Yeah.
All the way through.
But I mean, this is the thing. I actually thought... Actually, this kid can kind of act a bit.
Yeah,
he's not just kind of button-eyed song and dance antics. He can actually carry a film. Not a particularly good film, admittedly, but he's doing all the heavy lifting here.
I tell you what, films like this often live and die by the performance of the best friend.
There's a guy
in this called Thomas Lennon. Never heard of him. I thought he was rubbish. Really
he was
annoying.
Rubbish,
and
he was the kind of the low comic relief, wasn't he? And each time he came on, my kind of heart sank a bit.
He's trying to woo the school. He was a school geek, and now he's come back and he's invented some computer software, so he's phenomenally
billionaire guy, yeah.
But he's got Star Wars figures. I had Star Wars everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Lightsaber fights and all that.
Yeah, you see.
And you think, who is this film pitched at? And I guess it's pitched at the kids who love Zac Efron, who can then bring their parents, who are 40-something now, and remember Star Wars.
Yeah, I have to say, I know you thought Zac Efron was great. Matthew Perry, who's not in it that much, I thought he was rather good as the kind of man who's wasted his life and
disheveled. Well, he's looking kind of fittingly debauched now, isn't he?
Yeah,
so he's ripe for these roles.
Good old Matthew Perry. He probably is one of the friends who might actually make it. I've got a feeling he's going to kind of have the career that everyone wants Jennifer Aniston to have.
Surely it's too late for all of them now. This is, you know.
I'm going with Perry.
Right, okay.
Yo, Perry. That's 17 again, Zan. Let's stay with the kids and stay with Star Wars, because at the start of Race to Witch Mountain, which is not exactly a Film Weekly demographic sort of film, but we're going to go with it. At the start of that film, two stormtroopers get in the taxi of Dwayne The Rock Johnson. And I turned to you and said, well, Star Wars is everywhere this week. In fact, those are not just stormtroopers, because in the end, they turn out to be a couple of alien children in the back of his taxi. And why? Where do they want to go? They want to go to which mountain? Why do they want to go there? I don't know.
Hey, Jack, the UFO convention's in town.
I hadn't noticed. Where to?
We must travel in that direction.
Latitude 40.5.
We're just going to stick with that direction.
They're here for us.
Hang on!
There's no way.
My brother and I are not from your planet.
You don't look like aliens.
What does an alien look like?
Like little green people with antennas that take me to your leader, Earthlings.
Zan, this is a remake of a classic Disney movie that I'm fumbling around in the back of my brain. I think I've seen once before.
I think I've seen. It's surely one of those things that either we saw at the cinema and forgot all about when we were like seven, or we've seen on TV as an adolescent and forgotten about.
Yeah, so, I mean, why is it back, really? Because, I mean, special effects have got a lot better, and this seems to me more of like a, not a film, but a kind of trailer for a fun park ride that one day will soon exist.
A little bit. I mean, I guess presumably they're imagining that this is a sort of a beloved family classic that everyone wants to see again. And you know, as we're saying, I can't remember whether it was any good or not, but I'm sure must have had maybe a bit more charm than this. This is sort of oddly anonymous, and it stars Dwayne Johnson, you know, the artist formerly known as The Rock, as this sort of tough Vegas cabbie who's helping these two alien children to get back to their home planet, I think. But you kind of wonder, how is he helping them? Because these kids can put up false fields and throw fire from their hands and even control the cab with their minds. So you think, what role is he actually doing here? And he just seems to kind of wander around saying things like, kids, what's going on, kids? And you think, you know, you don't need to be here.
He doesn't. And he's not a great comic kind of cipher at all. And when the car doesn't go fast enough, he goes, oh, I'm doing it as fast as I can.
And they make it go faster.
They make it faster. Yeah. So they don't even need a driver.
Yeah. They should just push him out.
Yeah, why don't they? Because he's big. He does sort of have somehow fight this alien.
Yes, but if they can throw fire from their hands, they don't even need that, surely.
Because they come in peace.
Yeah, they come in peace, but you know, they can kick ass when needed.
There was one bit where the flying, I'm not giving too much away, the flying saucer arrives and it kind of opens up and you think, oh my gosh, remember the moment from E.T. when you're full of wonder.
Or close encounters. Well, yeah.
What's missing here is the awe.
The awe is certainly missing. What they do is they seem to have kind of this sort of celestial choral music over moments that you think, oh, this is where we're supposed to feel awe, and it just wasn't working.
We thought, ugh. There's a lot of plugs for Planet Hollywood.
There were loads of plugs for that, wasn't there?
Because this
take me to Planet Hollywood.
Yes, well, we certainly have with this film in the kind of cynical rehash stakes of Planet Hollywood. This one comes very high. So let's move on to Tony Manero. We're going back to Chile. We're going back to the Pinochet regime, where a man is trying to play out his dreams of being John Travolta's Saturday Night Fever character, Tony Manero.
Hi.
Hi. How you doing?
How you doing?
Hey, you know, you're a very good dancer.
I'm not a dancer.
I would like to meet you.
I would like to meet you.
Would you mind going away?
What?
What?
Don't be hurt, but I...
Don't be hurt.
Don't be
hurt.
I want
to be by myself now, you know?
So I've seen it 2001.
Yeah, so.
Zan, this is a rather dark and chilling tale from Chile.
Yes, it is. And it's one of those odd films. I've actually seen this film twice now. I saw it in Cannes last year, and then I saw it again this week. And I think the first time I saw it in Cannes, I was kind of bemused by it. It kind of wrong-footed me. And then the second time I saw it, I loved it. I think it's kind of brilliant.
Yeah.
But in a very distasteful, off-putting, kind of dank, chilly way.
So what is distasteful about it? Because ostensibly there's this bloke who's in love with John Travolta's character and just wants to wear the white suit and go on basically pop idol, whatever it is, or yeah. Stars in Their Eyes, and win the competition.
Yeah, and he's almost like sort of Frankenstein's interpretation of what a movie star should be. Like he's, you know, he's doing all the dance moves and mouthing the dialogue, but he's a terrible Manero impersonator, really. And yet kind of gets this sort of acolytes around him and is very kind of pampered and is a psycho as well. There's a sort of a great scene where he goes back to the sort of flea pit local cinema to see Saturday Night Fever for like the umpteenth time, and now they're playing Grease, and he gets so kind of incensed by this that he breaks into the booth and attacks the projectionist. And he's this... you know, it's a great performance from Alfredo Castro here, that he's kind of by turns pathetic and funny and scary.
He is absolutely, he's completely off the rails, isn't he?
Yeah.
But I wasn't sure if it was this psychoticness was his intentions of being so desperate to become the winner of the Tony Manero competition, or it was the regime of Chile, which kind of creeps in at the edges, which has made in this way.
I think that's what we're meant to think. I think that this is a sort of a kind of really dark satire on Pinochet-era Chile, where there's all these sort of political killings happening kind of off-screen or in the kind of the wings of the movie. And this character, this Raul, is almost like this sort of mascot for this zombie nation that's basically just kind of eating itself.
And indeed kind of eating another nation's culture, sort of American imperialism,
exactly.
Of course, coming in the form of Saturday Night Fever. And it's disco kind of, I suppose, the kind of glory of a Saturday night, the throwing off all the kind of, you know, chains of the week and living for the weekend.
Yeah, so it's the film within a film that he's cannibalising here. But you kind of have the sense that he's not really taking the actual message from the film. He's just kind of fixated on the white suit and the dancers.
Yeah, and of course there's some whores that he seems to hang out with in this terrible pub, and he wants to build a dance floor of glass so that it lights up. And he's kind of maniacal about it.
He makes a glitter ball by kind of breaking a mirror and gluing the pieces around an old football.
This is Tony Manero. I'd like to see it. It's a very good film, isn't it?
It's a great film. It's one of those films that I kind of watched in this sort of nervous revulsion and then found myself kind of laughing about openly afterwards on the street. And I don't know whether that says more about the film or more about me, and maybe I don't want to know.
Did you do a little dance, give it a little love?
I'd be even worse than Raoul, I think.
That's Tony Manero, which we kind of put down as a kind of foreign language classic in a way, because I've never seen a film like it, I have got to say. And I suppose that goes for the next film, and the final film, and will be my next guest. The director, Thomas Alfredson, has directed a very original horror movie from Sweden. It's called Let the Right One In, and it's about a little boy who's bullied at school and then makes friends with a teenage vampire who moves in next door. Happens all the time, Zan.
Happens all the time. And, you know, at the end of every year, we always get together and do our kind of top 10 movies of the year.
Yeah.
I'd like to kind of reserve a place quite high up for this.
Where would you let this one in at?
I think put it in at like 2 or 3. Mm. I don't want to say number one because that'll be too depressing if you think I've already seen the best film of the year and it's only April. So
that's quite exciting. You're exciting me.
Oh,
I
absolutely love this. I think this is absolutely wonderful.
Why?
Why it's the best kind of horror movie, in that it feels kind of real. However outlandish it gets, you totally believe in it. And it's strange, it's sad, it's moving, it's funny, weirdly at times. And it doesn't explain everything.
It
makes you kind of go halfway to meet it. And there's bits that is open to interpretation. And
absolutely.
You're not quite sure what it's saying.
It isn't like garlic and crucifixes, they'll work. You're like, is she a vampire? I don't really know. How's this working? What are the rules? That I didn't really know what the rules or laws of vampirism were in this film. That you discover them as we go along.
And it's superbly acted by the children. You know, the girl who plays the vampire is an actress called Lena Leanderson. And she's great. And only afterwards I found out that her voice is actually dubbed by an older actress to kind of give it that strange, kind of slight disconnected quality.
Think, because they're ageless, aren't they? There's a wonderful line in it when she goes, she says, how old are you? And she says, I've been 12 for a long time.
Yeah, that's a great bit. And then there's this other figure of the father figure who basically hunts for her. And you think, is it her father or could it possibly be like a former lover who's actually kind of aged while she stayed the same? It's a weird, weird film.
It's also a high school movie as well.
It's a coming of age story.
It's a love story. I mean, it really is. I've never really seen anything like it as well. People have compared it. I noticed on the poster, Guillermo del Toro, he sort of has really endorsed it, and people have compared it to the kind of European horror genre that's flourishing thanks to him with Devil's Backbone and Pan's Labyrinth. I've got to say, I much preferred Let the Right One In.
I much prefer this. I think del Toro is great, but he does kind of big gestures. It's big colours, it's kind of big motions. This is kind of icy and subtle, and altogether kind of intoxicating.
Recommendation for Let the Right One In from me and from Zan there. We're going to speak to its director, Thomas Alfredson, in just a minute. Zan, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Jess.
So, a ringing endorsement from the Film Weekly reviewers for Let the Right One In. I met up with the film's director, Thomas Alfredson, and started by asking him about that title. It's apparently very well known in vampire lore.
Yeah, and it's originally a quote from a Morrissey song. And it reflects that fact that you have to invite the vampire, otherwise the vampire cannot come in. And there is one scene in this film which is a new invention in the vampire mythos, and that is what happens to the vampire if she comes in uninvited. It's also the title reflects that you have to let the right person into your heart.
Yes, absolutely.
So, I mean, because you're like me. I'm not. I mean, I've seen vampire movies before. I'm familiar with them. I'm English, so of course the Hammer horror vampire movies are big for me. And even comic vampire movies with George Hamilton, Love at First Bite. That's a good title. Mm-hmm. These things are kind of familiar to any filmgoer. But your film attracted you. Why? Because it attracted me too. I thought it was, you know, something I'd never seen before. Is that what you wanted to do, rather than just rehash old vampire cliches?
Well, when I read the book from the beginning, I was very drawn into it because of how unsentimental this was told about this bullied boy. And that was the strongest element, I thought. And the horror thing just came with it, and in a very interesting and intriguing way. And it was so originally put together, because it's a very social, realistic tone and ambience, and it made it believable, because I usually get very uninterested when things are too fantastic.
Yes, me too. And but this one kept it always very in the everyday as well. I love the details of your film. I think are probably what delighted me most. But at the heart of your story, as you said, it is a story about a little bullied boy. And I think, and it's a story about outsiders and marginalised people and wounded people, I think. And some people will sort of say, well, it's interesting that you sort of on the side of the vampire slightly, that we've all got that bit of vampire in us. And I think that's probably what the film's about. Certainly that's what I took away from it.
It's very much about the suppressed animalistic sides of human nature, because nowadays we are mostly walking, talking heads, and not so familiar with our animalistic needs, such as violence. We have strong violent feelings, which we don't know so much anything about. So I suppose that the vampire is an expression of our violent sides.
Yes. There is definitely some kind of symbolism always read into a vampire, even if it's blood-sucking, a parasitical existence. Sometimes it's sexual, sometimes it's to do with the female cycle, sometimes it's to do with all these repressed ids and egos. But to put it in this setting, I suppose, was the twist, because not only it's the high school setting that I really liked, but it's the Swedish, I suppose it's a working-class town in the middle of winter.
Well, it's a suburb outside Stockholm, which is very typical for Stockholmers, which was constructed in the post-war years in Sweden, where the social democratic rule tried to create the utopic town.
Right.
Yeah, and that is very typical, and it of course didn't work as they thought.
We have those two in Milton Keynes, for example, and I'd love a vampire movie set in Milton Keynes.
Yeah.
That's where they should be. Stevenage is another new town that should be rife with vampires.
Yeah.
But I love your use of the great civic monuments, the tunnels, and the idea of these walkways is a very good thing for people, but actually they're very dark, and of course that's where vampires lurk.
Yeah. Sweden was a much more quiet place than it is now, I believe. So that is a very important part of the story, the silence. Mm-hmm.
Thomas, I thought, as we mentioned, the production design and the location of your film was very striking, but I thought one of the great things about it was the photography, particularly one shot where the little boy's been bullied and his trousers have been put in the toilet and they're wet, so he goes home in his shorts. And there's a wonderful scene of him in the snow, a long tracking shot, and the blue of his shorts is picked out by a blue of a slightly rusty Volvo. And I thought that was a genius bit of Swedish time and place photography. Who was your cinematographer? Because I thought it just looked brilliant.
Well, he's a genius. His name is Hoyte van Hoytema, and he's a Dutch photographer.
It doesn't sound Swedish.
Yeah. No, he's not. But he really thinks and works very much as a painter, I think. And he has a very philosophical approach towards photography, which was very interesting. And it was my first time working with him, and I hope not the last. And we invented we call it the spray lightning. It's as if you have a spray can with light in it. You go around in the room with this spray can, and there is no shadows. It's very super, super soft.
I suppose that Sweden, living in Sweden in the dead of winter, must be all about lighting. You know what I mean? There must be lights coming from every source where you wouldn't exist without kind of bright lighting.
Living in Sweden in January is... I mean, everything is artificial. Life is artificial. You have to import food. You have to have artificial light, artificial heating. Everything is artificial. So it's a very special... you really ask yourself, who the hell came with the idea of living here 5,000 years ago or whatever it was? That's a very spooky... feeling. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think the vampires were there first.
Yeah, they were.
Sweden's Thomas Alfredson there, director of Let the Right One In, already a Film Weekly favourite for 2009. My thanks to Barbara Broccoli and Michael Wilson. Good luck with their season of films at BFI Southbank. To Thomas Alfredson from Sweden and to Zan Brooks from West London. From me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly this week, Sarah Peters, is goodbye.